From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Frischberg writes witty songs about contemporary life, and he's a terrific pianist. On today's Fresh Air, you'll hear that for yourself when we feature a concert with Frischberg from our archives. Also from our archives, an interview with John Goodman. He's starring in the new film The Flintstones. Dashiell Hammett was born 100 years ago today. Maureen Corrigan pays tribute to the author of The Thin Man and The Maltese Falcon. Dennis Potter put an unusual spin on the hard-boiled detective genre in his TV miniseries, The Singing Detective. Potter is gravely ill. TV critic David Bianculli has a review of what may be Potter's last interview, recorded for British television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A chemical plant fire has forced authorities in Belpre, Ohio, to evacuate some homes. A Shell chemical plant is on fire. Authorities say 1,000 people have been evacuated. The fire is producing thick black smoke, and people in the town are being told to stay indoors and not to run their air conditioning. But officials say no injuries have been reported. The Coast Guard recommends that boaters avoid the Ohio River in the area. Officials say smoke is making it very hard to see. Asian countries are hailing President Clinton's decision to renew China's favorable trading status. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports from Tokyo.
The Japanese government said it welcomes Mr. Clinton's decision. Unlike the U.S., Japan has not linked trade with human rights in China. Japan places a priority on trying to help its giant neighbor maintain stability and developing markets for Japanese products there. Hong Kong, whose growing economy is closely linked with China, also welcomed President Clinton's announcement. Mr. Clinton's decision was widely expected in Hong Kong, so there was little reaction by the stock market there. The Hong Kong government had estimated that if China's trading status had not been renewed, up to 75,000 people would have lost their jobs locally. Australia also praised President Clinton's decision. I'm Marjorie Sun in Tokyo.
More than 40 European foreign ministers have ended a two-day summit in Paris. They've decided to try to settle border disputes and the problems of minorities in Central and Eastern Europe. Their goal is to prevent any more conflicts like the one now raging in Bosnia from breaking out. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The foreign ministers decided to hold roundtable negotiations among Eastern and Central European countries to deal with minority issues and border problems. One of the roundtables will focus on the status of Russian minorities in the Baltic states, and the other will deal with the problem of Hungarian minorities in Romania. The negotiations will be hosted by the European Union, which hopes the discussions will lead to the signing of bilateral treaties establishing good neighborly relations among Eastern European countries. Then in a year or so, the EU will put the treaties together in a European Stability Pact. But some analysts doubt this exercise in preventative diplomacy will work. Many countries don't want to thrash out their problems in an international forum. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Milwaukee police say two of their own officers have been arrested in connection with a slaying in Chicago. Police say the two officers were arrested this morning for the death of a worker in a northwest Chicago bar. A police spokesman says the slaying took place around 3 this morning. A Chicago police spokesman says his department won't release any information. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 2 points at 3,755. Trading is active. This is NPR. United Nations forces in the Rwandan capital of Kigali have moved nearly 500 civilians out of the city. They'd been trapped there by fighting for several weeks. The BBC's Mark Doyle reports from Kigali.
This exchange of people across the front lines of Kigali was a significant success for the UN and a demonstration that the mainly African peacekeepers have a crucial life-saving role. 240 supporters of the government were transferred to the government-held town of Runda, just east of the capital, and 240 Tutsis, the tribe from which the rebels draw most support, were taken to rebel-held territory on the other side of the city. The Tutsis had been living in a hotel in the city centre, surrounded by government militia who had threatened to massacre them, while the Hutus were housed in a football stadium in a rebel-held part of the city. The civilian head of the UN operation in Rwanda, Dr. Abdul Kabir, said the transfer had been a positive development. He said the fact that the UN had been able to get the two sides to agree on the delicate swap indicated that it might be possible to get wider agreements in the future.
Mark Doyle reporting. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan is defending the four interest rate increases by the central bank this year. He says the bank acted to snuff out inflation before it became a problem. He also says the bank acted to keep up the country's economic growth. Several senators are put out with the central bank's interest rate increases, which affect many consumer loans, like car loans and home mortgages. The government has issued new rules for meat safety. All packages of ground meat must now be labeled with instructions on safe handling and cooking. The label says meat may contain harmful bacteria that could cause illness. The labels will tell consumers to keep meat refrigerated before cooking it, and they will urge parents to make sure that their children's hamburger patties are completely cooked. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The jazz critic Mike Joyce once wrote that Dave Frischberg writes the kinds of songs that Johnny Mercer and Woody Allen might have come up with had they ever collaborated. Frischberg's songs are performed by many jazz and cabaret singers. Rosemary Clooney sang his Sweet Kentucky Ham at the White House and recorded his song Let's Eat Home on her latest recording. We're going to hear Dave Frischberg interpreting his own songs, accompanied by a great pianist, Dave Frischberg. He's recorded several albums. When we first broadcast this concert in 1991, the song most listeners called about wasn't yet on an album. Now it's the title track of his CD, Quality Time, on a small label called Sterling Records. Frischberg lives in Portland, Oregon. Our concert was recorded in the Fresh Air studio. Dave Frischberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
You've brought a brand new song with you, and I'd love to hear it.
Okay. Great, I'd be like to do it for you. I'll be late getting home from the office, and so will you, 'cause we both got a million calls to return and a million things to do. We're not seeing enough of each other, 'cause truth be told, we're up to our ears in our careers, and we're putting our hearts on hold. So darling, let me bring you up to speed. A little time together's what we need. Quality time. We both deserve a little quality time. We'll find a small hotel, remote and quiet. In case they want to sell, my firm could buy it. Then we develop it and gentrify it. We're talking quality time. Quality time. We owe ourselves a little quality time. In the Bahamas, we can let our stress go. We'll walk along the beach and dine al fresco. I'll take a power lunch with Robert Vesco. We're talking quality time. Come fly with me, unwind, kick back, relax. I'll bring my laptop fax. You'll work on your new screenplay. I'll update my resume. Quality time, a little frolic and frivolity time. We'll take a seminar on self-hypnosis, so we can learn to stop and smell the roses. We'll do a workshop on the grieving process. Learning to cry is no crime. We're talking quality time. We'll hit the tennis courts in our Adidas. Some influential sorts are bound to meet us. We'll play it smart, of course, and let them beat us. We're talking quality time. We'll find some upscale friends to share some space with, a wealthy couple we can interface with, a smart attorney we could start a case with. We're talking quality time. Come dine with me. This time you choose the wine. romance is the bottom line. And later, when we're alone, hang on, there's my other phone, we'll have a ball. But now I got to deal with this other call. We both been chewing more than we can bite off. We got to take at least a day and night off. I'll speak to Sid, he'll make it all a write-off. This may not cost us a dime. I'll fax you back with a plan of attack to let the quality time begin. We'll lock in the time frame, and you can pencil me in. Better pencil me in.
I love it. You know, you do something that Cole Porter used to do, which is like incorporate like proper nouns, you know, like names of people from the people
writing the song.
And, oh, that's a really funny song. You've gotten in everything.
That's my job.
You got your start as a pianist as opposed to a songwriter, pianist, and singer.
As a pianist, yes.
You were a sideman with a lot of musicians. You were a house pianist at one of the New York clubs. What made you realize that like your ultimate calling was going to be writing songs as well as playing and singing those songs too?
Well, as far as writing is concerned, I began to write soon after I got to New York and while I was a sideman, as you say, and I used to try to write so that other singers would be interested, or that because I never dreamed of myself as being the singer, and I would write to make other recording artists. I don't even know who they were, but to get their interest, to see if maybe, you know, who could it be, Connie Francis or Paul Anka, or would sing such a thing, you know, and it turned out that I was writing, I wrote terrible stuff. It wasn't very good because I didn't mean it. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I was kind of writing down to my song, and that doesn't make it. It was obvious that I wasn't really that kind of a writer, and I was just trying to write amateurishly. And so I stopped, and I began to just write what came naturally to me, and ended up being probably the only one who sings it.
What I like about composers singing their songs, you know, is that if you aren't like relying on a lot of technique, then there's something else in your voice. It's you know what I mean? In addition to...
Well, my main purpose is to make sure that the words are all understood.
Well, I think composers like you have a way of kind of putting across a song and of putting a certain kind of, the right emotion, whether it's wit or sentiment. Do you know what I mean? Just kind of striking the right emotion in the way you're performing it.
Well, that could be. And if there's any technique to what I do as far as accompanying myself, I think it might lie in the fact that a lot of times I sing to silence. I stop playing when I sing certain songs, especially up-tempo jazz things, and I leave open spaces for my voice to execute the music. And then I hear other singers trying to do some of my up-tempo songs, and I wonder why it sounds cluttered, and I wonder why they express difficulty. That's a hard song, you know, to get those things out. Well, then I see, well, the reason I'm getting it out is because instinctively I stop playing behind myself at that moment and allow the words to happen. And, of course, that doesn't occur to them because someone else is playing the piano, and it wouldn't occur to him either, you know.
What's an example of a song where you lay out like
Well,
that?
For instance, a song that, like Zoot Walks In, which is full of jazz articulation, you know. Jazz is a saxophone sound. Not every player's got his own sound. Well, you see how much there was silence in back of me. So other singers try to sing this, and they got piano player playing. Jazz is a saxophone sound. You know what I mean? And they got
exactly.
All this stuff going on in back of them. Naturally, it sounds a little cluttered. I've noticed that myself recently. I can get the words out because I'm accompanying myself, and I know enough to stop playing at those moments.
Have you ever sang with anybody else accompanying you?
Oh, only for brief hysterical moments. I sang with a full orchestra once. That was really terrifying. In California, Peter Matz was conducting, and it was a tribute to Johnny Mandel, and I was doing a Mandel song called El Cajon with a full orchestra behind me. What a panicky feeling. I sent Peter Matz the music, and he called me back on the phone. He said, don't you want to put this maybe a whole tone higher or maybe a minor third higher? I said, well, gee, I can't sing that high. He says, well, you got it in a very confidential key. And I realized that, you know, I wrote most of my keys for myself in a range that I can handle, but it is a confidential one. And when you got an orchestra in back of you, you can't sing like that. You know, you can't sing. Jazz is a size. You got to sing. Jazz is a size. You got to do it because otherwise you're not going to be heard. See, so that that's terrifying to sing with a orchestra, and it's also scary to sing with another piano player. I did that a couple of times. It's like jumping out of a plane without a chute. You know?
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll hear some music with our guest Dave Frischberg. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1991 concert with Dave Frischberg. Dave, you got another song for us?
Sure. I thought maybe I'll play the piano a little bit, huh?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
I'll do... I always end up playing Duke Ellington music. I don't know why. I just seem to gravitate toward it. He's one of my favorite people. This is The Mooch. Duke wrote this in the late 1920s. And in the middle of it, I've incorporated a more recent Ellington tune called Jones. I kind of slide into that in the middle.
Thank you.
love what you do with that. I really think of the Mooch. Maybe there's like an Ellington solo record, and I'll sound stupid because I don't know about it, but I think of the Mooch as being one of the Ellington compositions that really accentuates the reed section with you know, the reeds kind of sliding between notes and wailing.
Yeah, right, right.
Is it a hard one to do at the piano, to figure out what to do with it at the piano?
Not really. I mean, I do something different with it, I guess, every time, but I do kind of plan for it to peter out at the end. Got the right guy, right?
You said something once to Whitney Balliot of The New Yorker about lyrics that I quite like, that good lyrics come up to the edge of poetry and turn left.
Well, it was one of those things I wish I had never said. It's utter nonsense. I have no idea what that means.
Well, I know what it means to me.
Well, I don't know. I guess I knew it at the time what it meant to me, too, but I was horrified to see that he wrote it down and used it.
Well, I'm just here to, I guess, embarrass you.
No, I don't know what that means. But I do know that I think a better, more telling little aphorism was said by Frank Lesser, who said that lyric writing is not literature and it's not poetry, it's journalism. And I think that really says it.
Since we're talking about lyrics, let me ask you to do another of your own. And I think we've got a song coming up that's, I think it's really become one of your most popular.
Sweet
songs.
Kentucky Ham.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's one of my most popular, but I was very flattered and pleased to receive a book in the mail the other day from a writer named Terry Teachout. He's written memoirs called City Limits about his life as a young boy and a student in Sykeston, Missouri. And he quoted this song, Sweet Kentucky Ham, as part of a chapter on life on the road with a jazz band, Woody Herman. And I was very pleased. It's a terrific book, by the way. Would you like to hear this song?
No, I was just pretending.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here it is. It's 6 p.m. Supper time in South Bend, Indiana. And you figure what the hell you can eat in your hotel. So you order up room service on the phone. Watch the local news and dine alone. You got to take what little pleasures you can find when you've got sweet Kentucky ham on your mind, on your mind. Nothing but sweet Kentucky ham on your mind. It's 10 p.m. They're rolling up the sidewalks in Milwaukee. And the only place to eat is just across the street. So you sit there with a bowl of navy bean. And you turn the pages of your magazine. And you feel you want to quit while you're behind. 'Cause you've got sweet Kentucky ham on your mind, nothing but sweet Kentucky ham on your mind. And you feel like you're forever on the phone. 10:30, let it ring. Dial again, same damn thing. And you're really getting hungry for some talk. Grab a shower. Take a walk. It's 1 a.m. They're serving up Last Call in Cincinnati. It's still a nighttime town if you know your way around. And despite yourself, you find you're wide awake. And you're staring at your scrambled eggs and steak. And you must admit your heart's about to break when you think of what you left behind. And you got sweet Kentucky ham on your mind, nothing but sweet Kentucky ham on your mind.
Really nice.
Thank
you. Dave Frischberg. It has been a real treat to have you here. I really want to thank you for coming and playing for us. It's really been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dave Frischberg, you can hear some of his recent songs on his CD, Quality Time, on the Sterling record label. Our concert was recorded in 1991. We'll go out with a recording of one of his often requested songs, My Attorney Bernie. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm impressed with my attorney, Bernie. I'm impressed with his influential friends. He's got very big connections, and I follow his directions. Bernie knows his way around, and so I always do what Bernie recommends. I am blessed with my attorney, Bernie. I'm impressed with the way he runs the store. He's got Dodger season boxes and an office full of foxes. It's amazing all the different things your average guy might need a lawyer for. Bernie tells me what to do. Bernie lays it on the line. Bernie says we sue, we sue. Bernie says we sign, we sign. I'm in touch with my attorney, Bernie. In a clutch, he can speed right to the scene. And if I'm locked up in the jail with just one phone call for my bail, he said to call his club collect or deal directly with his answering machine. When I dine with my attorney, Bernie, he buys wine from the rare imported rack. That's 'cause Bernie is purist, not your polyester tourist. Bernie waves the glass around a while, then takes a sip and always sends.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up from the archives, a conversation with actor John Goodman. The co-star of Roseanne is now starring in the movie The Flintstones. Also, Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of Dashiell Hammett, one of the writers who created the hard-boiled detective genre. Hammett was born 100 years ago today. Dennis Potter, who wrote the TV miniseries The Singing Detective, is gravely ill. After he got sick, he taped an extensive interview for British television. TV critic David Bianculli has seen it and has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Three workers are missing in a Shell chemical plant fire in southeastern Ohio. Up to 1,700 people have been evacuated in Ohio and West Virginia. Scott Varner of member station WOUB has this report.
The fire at the Shell chemical plant is now under control, and the black cloud of smoke that covered parts of Belpre, Ohio, seems to be gone. It should be soon when residents in the one-mile region around the plant are able to return home. But at a press briefing around 3:30 this afternoon, the words that no one wanted to hear finally came from the chemical plant's manager. Three workers at the plant have now been listed as missing. The men were scheduled to be working in the area of the plant that apparently exploded and then caught fire. For now, the area has been declared a disaster by Ohio's governor. For National Public Radio, I'm Scott Varner reporting from Belpre, Ohio.
Some lawmakers are trying to get the Justice Department to support their efforts to get the tobacco industry to reveal more about itself. Seven House members say they want an investigation into whether the heads of the nation's seven largest tobacco firms lied to Congress. The executives testified last month they had had no evidence that nicotine was addictive. But Massachusetts Democrat Martin Meehan says information that has come out since then indicates they did know. The Tobacco Institute has had no comment. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan is defending the central bank's increase of interest rates this year. He told members of the Senate today that more rate hikes may be needed. UPI's Craig Smith reports.
Alan Greenspan appeared before the Senate Banking Committee just a few hours after the Commerce Department reported the economy was stronger during the first quarter than thought. While most economists expected the gross domestic product to be revised downward from an annual rate of 2.6% to 2.4%, the rate of growth was revised upward to 3%. Greenspan said the four hikes in interest rates since early February were needed to dampen any inflationary pressures. And he made it clear the Fed is willing to do it again, even if it risks hurting growth. Craig Smith, Washington.
The sex discrimination suit against the Citadel Military College has been delayed for 2 weeks. The federal judge hearing the case says he needs time after 10 days of trial to review the case before final arguments. Plaintiff Shannon Faulkner says she wants to be a full member of the all-male state-funded school because of its prestige and military training. She's suing because the school admitted her before finding out she was female. The government says the gross domestic product increased at a rate of 3% in the first 3 months of this year. That's a dramatic slowdown from the end of last year, when the GDP grew at a rate of 7%. The Commerce Department says an unusually cold winter, along with a California earthquake, were to blame. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 3.5 points to close at 3,757. This is NPR. Russian authorities say one kidnapper was killed in a shootout today with Special Forces commandos. The firefight ended a hostage taking. Three other kidnappers have been captured. Their four remaining hostages are safe. The incident came to an end hours after the kidnappers fled aboard a helicopter with millions of dollars in ransom money. They had taken over a school bus with children, parents, and teachers who were taking an outing. At one point, the kidnappers had threatened to kill the kids. The Russian Interior Minister says the kidnappers are from a region of Russia that he claims is known for its criminal gangs. Illinois officials say they're investigating complaints that vehicles damaged in last year's Midwest flooding are being sold across the country. Carl Volz of member station WCVU reports.
Al Pace of the Illinois Secretary of State's office says cars that spent last summer underwater during the Mississippi River flood have turned up on used car lots around the country. Pace says dishonest dealers are cleaning up the vehicles and pawning them off at auctions in the Midwest.
Rather than turning the damage into an insurance company where a salvage title would be issued for it, they might attempt to fix it themselves, dry it out, clean it up, and then sell it as a legitimate used car, if you will, or a clean car.
Pace says it's hard for dealers to detect the damage until the cars develop electrical problems. He advises checking for water damage in the floorboards or tracing the car's title to see where the former owners lived. For National Public Radio, this is Carl Volz in Peoria, Illinois.
Former Israeli General Ariel Sharon says he's going to run against Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin in 1996. That's the first year Israeli voters will choose their political leader by direct election rather than by party ticket. Sharon's announcement has made rightist politicians angry. They interpret this as a challenge to the head of the Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Everyone knows John Goodman as Roseanne's TV husband. During his breaks from the show, he's made several movies like Born Yesterday, Matinee, Barton Fink, The Babe, Sea of Love, and Punchline. Now he's starring in the movie The Flintstones. When we spoke last year, I asked John Goodman about his audition for Roseanne. I wanted to know what he was told about his character, Dan Connor.
Wow. They laid it real simple. Didn't really sketch it in much. Blue collar. I think they wanted somebody that could stand up to her. Whatever that means. Hire a redwood tree.
What's it like to have a TV family? You know, all of us who grew up watching TV have always compared our families with the families that we watched on TV. Now, so now you have a TV family.
Yes, I do. I guess they're pretty much better paid than most families. I never really thought of them that much as a family, in as much as, you know, you think of a cast that you work with as family sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that's about the extent of it.
Who were the TV families that you really liked when you were young watching television?
I loved the Cleavers. I couldn't wait to see him. I just loved Beaver because he just seemed so real. He'd talk about the same things that we talked about. I think the writers had something going there. And then everybody knew an Eddie Haskell.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew somebody like Beaver's older brother. And I grew up without a dad, so Ward was a little surreal anyway. But I dug them.
Did you ever?
I never really quite got Father Knows Best.
Not having a father when you were growing up, did you assume that real fathers were like Ward Cleaver and...
Nah, I seen the guys next door. Hell, I knew what they were like. They were, for the most part, guys like Dan Connor.
How was your life changed by people seeing you as Dan Connor, the character from Roseanne?
Well, I lost my anonymity for the most part. So it's a little difficult going places.
Do you think people are more presumptuous about approaching you when they know you from TV as opposed to movies? Because you're at home with them.
Yeah, I've always felt that. I talk to people who do movies exclusively, and when you come into somebody's house, they're more familiar with you.
So do they try to get familiar with you when they run into you at a restaurant?
Oh, yeah, I'm like everybody's best friend. I get a lot of headlocks and back slaps and stuff like that. For the most part, I mean, people really mean well. They just they don't realize that it can be a little off-putting sometimes.
If you're a self-conscious person, does it make it even worse?
Yeah, and how. I mean, I got buddies that love it. They thrive on it. They love being recognized. I always see somebody looking at me and... a little too long, I assume my fly's open.
You know, I'm thinking about how differently you handle fame from, say, Roseanne and Tom Arnold. And they've used fame to make their lives into performance pieces in a way.
Yeah, that's... human life is a performance piece. That's very interesting. Now, they... Rose likes it. I'm uncomfortable with it.
John Goodman is my guest. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Goodman. Can we talk about your early life a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, you were born in St. Louis in 1952. Your father died before your second birthday, so your mother supported the family. Were you the only one of your friends from a single-parent family when you were growing up?
Yeah, actually, I believe I was. I never really thought about that, but yeah, everybody else had two parents.
Did that make you feel very different?
It did. I didn't dwell on it, but it was something that was at the back of my mind that I was aware of all the time. But it was, I to be honest, I wouldn't know what it would be like to grow up with a father. So I don't, you know, it was neither better nor worse. It was just different.
What did your mother do to make a living?
She would she took in ironing sometimes. She had what was the equivalent of a daycare center now. They called it babysitting back then. But parents would go to work, and they'd drop their kids off at the house. So we played. I mean, it must have been rough on Mom, but we played a lot, had a lot of fun. And then she was a clerk at a drugstore, and she worked at a barbecue joint when I was in high school, so I could steal her tips.
Were you watching a lot of movies, TV, listening to a lot of music when you were young?
At that age, the TV would keep breaking, so I read a lot. But, we'd go to the Crest show on matinee days and see stuff, see movies. But, I watched a little bit of television.
So you said you read a lot of books. What kind of books would you read?
good stuff. For the most part, stuff you're supposed to read, like Stevenson and Mark Twain. And then when I got in like 7th and 8th grade, I turned into a little James Bond nerd. I'd go and I'd go and get these paperbacks. I don't know where the hell I got the money from, and then read them. I turned into quite the little geek.
Like, what's geeky about reading stuff? James Bond, though? Those weren't geeky books.
What a cool guy.
Yeah, well, I read just about all of them, I think.
I was like a chubby 11-year-old with broken glasses, dirty pants, and just, picture myself on the Riviera chain-smoking Galois.
You know what I remember?
Talking to some other 7th grade girl. Suave.
Well, one thing that I'll always remember from the James Bond books is his comma of black hair.
Oh, his comma of black hair that fell down over his right eye.
Yeah.
His tiger sinewed body.
There were some descriptions that would be exactly the same, I think, in every book.
Yeah, and they fit me pretty damn well at the time, I think.
So what were the big turning points in your pre-acting life?
I think a lot of it revolved around athletics. I had a cousin that played football at Missouri University when I was in 4th grade, and the sun rose and set on him, and that's what I wanted to do. So I play football a lot, whenever I could. And when I got into high school, that's what I geared everything towards, was high school football. And I was terrible. I mean, I wasn't very good. I was slow, lazy. But the fact that I was on a team and wearing a uniform, I think made it. I was a football player.
So it made it easier to get dates?
Well, no. I mean, let's not say that. I was very, very shy, very backwards. I didn't get my first date until I was 16 years old, and it was a fix-up job. And halfway there to the girl's house, I begged my friend to stop the car, let me out. I've got to sty anything, I've got to get out of this. But I went through with it, and then... I didn't have a girlfriend until I was in college, really.
Because you were shy?
Yeah, pathologically.
There is this real connection between performers and shyness, and I think a lot of people find it hard to understand how you could be so big on stage.
I was reading an article
on
Peter Fonda talking about his father. He said that his father, he finally discovered that he wasn't angry at him. He just was extremely shy. And I thought that was fascinating.
Well, John Goodman, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Goodman recorded last year. He stars in The Flintstones. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Well, Robert, it was quite a busy day at the White House yesterday.
Sure was, and we'll be catching up today on the decision to extend most favored nation status to China and to de-link that decision on trade policy from human rights concerns, but also on the documents disclosed yesterday about Hillary Rodham Clinton's commodities trading, and also the resignation under fire of a White House aide who took a Marine helicopter to go play golf about 50 miles from the White House. In addition today, news of the return of Alexander Solzhenitsyn to Russia, and also a history of trade sanctions, when they seem to work and when they don't seem to work.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Dashiell Hammett. Commentator Maureen Corrigan thinks that our avid mystery reader president, Bill Clinton, should declare today a national holiday so all Americans could take time off to read and appreciate one of our great national treasures, the hard-boiled mystery.
Of all the great dead American writers of the 20th century, Dashiell Hammett is the one I would have most liked to have known. He's also a writer I'm glad I never did get to meet. People close to Hammett, including his longtime love, Lillian Hellman, described him as a boozer and a womanizer. But like his greatest detective creation, Sam Spade, who Hammett characterized as a blonde Satan, Hammett, too, was a puzzling moral hybrid. He had real guts and integrity. For instance, when World War II began, Hammett was 48 years old and sickly. But he somehow conned Army recruiting officers into letting him enlist. A few years later, during the McCarthy period, Hammett refused to name names. He served 6 months in a federal penitentiary and was blacklisted and broke until his death in 1961. Hammett also endured one of the longest writing blocks on record. After the publication of his last novel, The Thin Man, in 1934, he'd spend most mornings staring at a blank piece of paper. He did this for over 20 years. That's courage. Maybe instead of the dubious pleasure of meeting Hammett, I'd really like to have shadowed him during the 1920s, followed in his mental footsteps as he was creating the new kind of mystery people would call hard-boiled. When he was young, Hammett had actually worked as a Pinkerton detective, and he knew none of his colleagues sounded like Sherlock Holmes. Hammett helped Americanize the mystery story by making his private eyes speak the pared-down poetry of the mean city streets. Besides Sam Spade, Hammett also created an overweight investigator called the Continental Op, whose name is short for operative or detective. These two characters represent some of our first modern heroes. They're men so disillusioned by the post-World War I world, they cling only to their work for meaning. Here's the Continental Op explaining himself in an early short story entitled The Gutting of Kufignal. "I'm a detective," the op says, "because I happen to like the work. I don't know anything else, don't enjoy anything else, don't want to know or enjoy anything else." The sense of isolation, exhaustion, and minimal expectation that comes through in the op's words is echoed not only in other detective stories, but also in the writing of high modernists like Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, André Gide, and William Faulkner, all of whom admired Hammett. Of course, Hammett also lives on in the work of contemporary detective fiction writers, and this summer promises a bumper crop of bumped-off bodies. Robert B. Parker has a new Spencer mystery. I haven't read it yet, but I will. Even when Parker's writing is on automatic pilot, we fans have to read him just to keep current with Spencer's extended family. I've heard some people complain that women PIs are too PC. These are usually the same people who claim the detective story reached its zenith with Mickey Spillane. If you listen to them, you'll miss out on two terrific new novels. Linda Grant's fourth Catherine Saylor mystery, entitled A Woman's Place, is a superb thriller about sexual harassment via email. And in Tunnel Vision, the new Sarah Paretsky mystery, V.I. Warshawski's world is crumbling. She's losing clients, being evicted from her office building, and turning 40. Because her computer is wrecked, V.I. has to solve a murder the old-fashioned gumshoe way, by foot, fist, and fast thinking. Sam Spade would be proud.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. The potency of our hard-boiled fantasies was explored by the British writer Dennis Potter in his entertaining and innovative TV miniseries, The Singing Detective. He showed the impact of pop music on our inner lives in his previous miniseries, Pennies from Heaven, which was adapted into a film. In February, Potter was diagnosed with inoperable cancer of the liver and pancreas and given 3 months to live. 2 months later, just before his 59th birthday, he appeared on England's Channel 4 on a program called Without Walls to tape a 70-minute interview that would look back on his life and work. In America, no TV network or cable station has yet announced plans to broadcast it, but our TV critic David Bianculli couldn't wait.
In the entire history of television, there are two writers who tower above all others. In America, it was Paddy Chayefsky, who eventually left TV to do film. In England, it was and is Dennis Potter, who started writing TV dramas in the mid-60s and hasn't ever stopped. That's one thing you should know right off. Here's another. The entire Without Walls program and Potter's most recently completed miniseries, Lipstick on Your Collar, were just acquired by the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. If you're anywhere near the city, that's the place to go, for now, to see what you're about to hear. And there's a third thing you should know. Not even Potter could have written something as dramatic as the way he's chosen to play out the last chapter of his life. The day he was given 3 months to live, he started work on one final project. He took the central character of one miniseries he'd just about finished writing, called Karaoke, and made him the hero of a new drama called Cold Lazarus. That one's about a character who's dying, and whose head is frozen for 400 years, then thawed out. His memories, which essentially are Potter's memories, feed the virtual reality machines of the future with a new type of entertainment, pictures from an otherwise long-forgotten past. Potter began a daily writing schedule, although he was in constant pain. Even during his TV interviews with British TV host Melvin Bragg, he stopped a few times to take a swig of liquid morphine. But what he says, despite that, is amazingly lucid.
I do have a sense of vocation, and I have it to the, I will have it to the last ounce of my life, the last second. I have the sense, and I'm proud that I've got it, and I'm no longer ashamed of saying, yes, I have had a sense of vocation. And it was writing.
Between swigs of morphine, Potter covers a lot of ground, including what it's like to live with so few days remaining.
Below my window in Ross, when I'm working in Ross, for example, there now at this season, the blossom is out in full now there in the west early. There's a plum tree. It looks like apple blossom, but it's white. And looking at it, instead of saying, oh, that's nice blossom, you know, now, the last week, looking at it through the window when I'm writing, it is the whitest, frothiest, blossomest blossom that there ever could be, you know. And I can see it. And things are both more trivial than they ever were and more important than they ever were. And the difference between the trivial and the important doesn't seem to matter. But the nowness of everything is absolutely wondrous.
In this interview, Potter also looks back on his father, an unschooled coal miner from a hamlet called the Forest of Dean.
He would sort of hover on in the doorway or lean against the door jamb and say, so all right, our dad? I'm writing. So I'd be irritated because I'd go in and talk to him. I was finishing something or I was doing or I was engaged in something. Yes, Dad, yeah, I'm sure, you know, all that. So sure it's all right, mind, all but, you know, that anxiety to communicate but doing it wrongly. But it now, of course, I'd say, you know, come on in, Dad. Sake, sit down, let, you know, it doesn't matter about that now, that minute, you know, but of course I can't, and yet there's a sense in which by even saying it, you see, I've done it, I've said it, come on in, Dad.
And finally, after describing his work in progress, Potter examines why, with so little time and so much pain, he's still writing for television. He even describes a last wish of sorts, hoping that England's Channel 4 and the BBC will get together to produce and present his final work.
I can create a space to do 10 pages a day, flat out, which is what when I go flat out, I go flat out. And believe me, with a passion I've never felt, I feel I can write anything at the moment. I feel I can fly with it. I feel like I can really communicate what I'm about and what the world, and what I feel, and what the world ought to know. My only regret is to die 4 pages too soon, you know. If I can finish, then I'm quite happy to go. I don't mind, you know, I'm quite serene. I haven't had a single moment of terror since they told me. I know I'm going to die, whether it's in 4 weeks' time, 5 weeks' time, 6 weeks' time, might be longer. I might make 8, 9, 10, who knows? But the histology of it suggests that I should already be dead. But I know what's keeping me going. And if that passion, if those two organizations could do this, then I would have left something that, in the first case, I am proud of, because I've written so much of it I know, and I've got the same feeling that I had with Singing Detective and Pennies from Heaven, only even more so, and Blue Remembered Hills, that I would go out with a... I can now be arrogant and boastful and effort to everything. I could go out with a fitting memorial.
This interview already is a fitting memorial. It's the most dramatic, inspirational, life-affirming TV interview since Bill Moyers talked with Joseph Campbell on PBS back in 1988. I urge you to see Without Walls if you're in New York. And I especially urge PBS or some cable network to pick up the American broadcast rights and show this program as quickly as possible. Dennis Potter and television deserve nothing less.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Special thanks to the Museum of Television and Radio in New York for making the Dennis Potter tapes available. Our weekly archive shows have been put together with the help of our intern, Devin Reif, who's assisted us on many other shows in many ways. The bad news is that he's leaving our show. The good news is that he's leaving for a great new job. We wish him well in his move to Portland, Oregon. And as we wish him good luck, we wish you a good holiday weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, for Memorial Day, war memories of the general who led the first major land battle Americans fought in Vietnam, the Battle of Ia Drang. We also hear from war novelist Tim O'Brien, and Maureen Corrigan reviews a novel about World War I. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.